Thanks to everybody for showing up. I'm excited to discuss this research with you and to entertain all of your questions, which I'm sure will be very on point. So the first thing I want to do is just tell you how I got involved in this topic. Because as Mette mentioned, I came to this subject from the position of a political violence person, kind of a sub-state terrorism, nationalist conflict, political violence person. So I was really looking at things blowing up. So if it was blowing up, I was kind of focused on it. And I was writing my dissertation on why terrorist groups tend to persist in democratic countries. And basically, I got this invitation while I was in my final year of graduate school over email to this workshop that was nearby called People, Power, and Pedagogy. And what they were trying to do was get security studies academics interested in the topic of nonviolent conflict to incorporate it into their syllabi and their courses on political violence. So the reason I applied to this is, like I said, it was nearby and it was free. So it looked really good on my CV to go to a pedagogical workshop so I could look like I was a thoughtful teacher. And I went to this workshop, and in advance they sent me this box of books by a bunch of people whom I'd never heard of, like Peter Ackerman and Jack Duvall, Gene Sharp, Kurt Schock, a bunch of other names which I can give you citations later if you're interested. And it was all about strategic nonviolent conflict. So there were a couple of ways this is different from my typical view of nonviolent conflict. The first was that they weren't talking about pacifist nonviolence. So they weren't talking about an ideology or a moral position on using peaceful methods of resistance. They were talking about strategic nonviolent conflict, and emphasis on the latter word, conflict. They were talking about actually prosecuting an act of conflict against an oppressive opponent, basically. So they weren't talking about pacifism or passive resistance. They were talking about active resistance, using everything short of physically harming or threatening to physically harm an opponent. So this is a term that what I use is civil resistance. I use it rather than nonviolent resistance, because when I say nonviolent resistance, all of my security studies people think that I've gone peaceable. So I use civil resistance because it emphasizes the active nature of the conflict. And also it doesn't provoke all the baggage that people have around the word nonviolent. So it's kind of an unfortunate thing that it's been described, nonviolent resistance, as something that's opposite from violent resistance, or that's the absence of violence, because it's, as I said, very active, not passive. And basically, there are hundreds of ready-made weapons available to civilians to prosecute an active resistance without using violence. So that's kind of what civil resistance is, just as a background. So I go to this workshop as a guns and bombs person, and they're trying to make the argument that nonviolent resistance is a strategically superior choice to using armed insurrection or armed insurgency. And I was very dubious because, as I said, I spent all of my time getting in the minds of terrorists and people and trying to imagine under what circumstances I would be driven to use violence to try to help me understand why they would. And I always came up with the same sort of philosophy, which is that I would have a really good reason to use it. And it would probably be because it's the last resort. It'd probably be because I thought it would yield results toward my objective, and that it was basically a necessary and effective means of getting what I wanted. So when they're saying, you know, nonviolent resistance is strategically superior, I was shocked, actually, at first, that there would be people that would argue this, given the state of our world. So I played the devil's advocate for about a week, and I was like the irritating person in the crowd, you know? Kept raising my hand and bringing up cases, and they kept bringing up cases and saying, well, you know, in Poland, the Solidarity Movement, you know, threw off this unbelievably repressive regime, communist regime, et cetera. And I'd say, yeah, but China failed, you know, so what do you think? And they said, well, you know, there were some strategic mistakes made in Tiananmen. And so we'd have these back and forths about it. And ultimately, what we figured out toward the end of that week is that there are probably lots of really good arguments for why nonviolent resistance is strategically superior, but there are also good arguments for why violence would be strategically superior, and what we had to do is look at the record. So basically, Nobody had done it. I mean, how many people are aware of the Correlates of War data set? Anybody heard of it? It's like the big, large-end data set on war. So if you ever wanted to, if you wanted to look up when a war started between 1800 and today, you could go to the Correlates of War data set, and it would give you the counts. And basically what they count is any type of armed conflict where there's more than 1,000 battle deaths. That goes into the data set on the Correlates of War. So we've got that information. We've got all kinds of data from Swedish colleagues at Uppsala who have collected data on civil war and non-state actor armed conflict. We've got tons of data on armed conflict, and there was no correlates of nonviolent conflict data set. I was so disappointed. And so what happened is I had to actually collect it myself. So over the next 2 years, what I did is I started out by going into country-level reports and encyclopedias and newspapers and case studies and everything that had ever been written basically on what people were doing in countries at given times. And I tried to collect data that used a very similar criteria to what the Correlates of War data did, which was that I looked at where there were more than 1,000 people engaged in a continuous observable tactics against an opponent. These are civilians, though, not armed guerrillas, so it distinguishes itself from many of these other data sets. And I used kind of the strict criteria, which is that it had to fall into one of three categories. It had to be for regime change, that is, they wanted a current government to be thrown out. It had to be for secession, which is becoming an independent country that never existed. Or it had to be for the expulsion of a foreign military occupation. So I wanted to do those three hard goals because I have this sense that nonviolent resistance maybe only works for the really easy stuff, like labor rights or civil rights or gender rights or economic rights. So there was this kind of notion out there, a hypothesis I had in my mind, that violence is what's good for the hard stuff like regime change and secession and anti-occupation. Civil resistance works really well if you just want to sort of nudge reforms, you know. So this is the notion I had in my mind. So I applied this very strict criteria to my collection and just looked at the hardest types of conflicts. And what I ended up with after the couple of years was, you know, a number of different campaigns, and then I sent them all over the world to different experts on both nonviolent resistance and area experts to ask them, are these campaigns, were they there? Especially the failed ones. Did I miss any failed ones? You know, ones that never really took off and got off the ground. And, you know, and then they gave me some feedback. I incorporated the feedback, 2-year process. Finally ended up with a data set of about over 300 nonviolent and violent campaigns, non-state actors, that were falling into one of those three criteria. So after I had that, I collected data on a few things. I looked at the highest number of active participants in the campaigns, whether they were violent or nonviolent. So here I was looking for not just people that sympathized for it or that you could sort of count as passive supporters. I was looking for people that were sort of on the front lines when they were confronting or prosecuting the conflict against the opponent. Then I looked at security force defections because there was a hypothesis thrown out there by Gene Sharp that one way that nonviolent campaigns could succeed is by converting the opponent's pillars of support. So instead of having this notion of power where power is really central and you're attacking the center, this notion of power is that there is a center, but it's pretty small, and it's supported by different pillars like the security forces, economic elites, educational institutions, banks, you know, these sorts of things. And that what nonviolent conflict does is it tries to chip away at those pillars of support. And then when the regime tries to use them to crack down on the campaign or to maintain power in the long run, they aren't reliable. They don't participate in that process. So I used a really hard version of that, which would have been security force defections, which, you know, in many cases are the hardliners in the country who aren't going to give up as easily as maybe the business elites when their wallets get hit. So basically, I looked at whether the security forces defected or not, and that could just mean that when an order came down for them to shoot, they didn't cooperate. So then I also looked at different levels of government repression, because I'm thinking, well, nonviolent resistance isn't going to work against really brutal regimes. I mean, if these regimes crack down really hard on these campaigns, then of course you can't just be out there protesting. You're going to go home, and it's not going to work. So I looked at violent repression against the campaigns. I also looked at whether the campaigns received material support from a foreign state. And this came from the notion that, well, if nonviolent campaigns are really working, it's probably because they're like the puppets of some great power out there that's giving them all kinds of money and all kinds of intelligence and is really helping them to sort of poke at the regime. And so I wanted to look at that to see whether that made a difference. And then I looked at a bunch of features of the opponents themselves, whether they were democracies or authoritarian regimes, the level of military capabilities that the regimes had at their disposal to confront these oppositional movements, the country's population, what its size was like, whether there was ethnic heterogeneity, et cetera. So these are just very typical demographic variables. And so after I had all of that, I went through and I made an assessment of whether the campaign succeeded or failed. And at the outset, I adopted a tertiary criteria. They had to either have succeeded 100%, in other words, they changed the existing regime, they became a new country, or they kicked out a foreign military occupation. So if they set out to achieve any of those three things and they got it, then that counted as a success. The second criteria was the partial success. And I didn't originally think that I would need this, but it turns out that in some cases, there is significant progress made toward a goal like de facto autonomy from an independent country, which makes you more or less an independent country, de facto, if not by name. So in those cases, I did put them in a partial success category. And then there's failure, which means that you didn't achieve what you said you wanted, and you didn't make enough progress to be put into the partial success category either. So what I ended up with was this pretty big data set with lots of different variables and outcomes. And then I looked at the results about outcomes. And I was totally awestruck that actually the nonviolent campaigns in the data set were over twice as successful as the violent ones. They're also more than twice as partially successful as the violent ones. And the violent campaigns are much more likely to fail. Moreover, this trend is actually increasing over time. You can see here that the rate of success for nonviolent movements is increasing, while the rate of failure for violent movements is also increasing. So the question is, why is this? So I had to call up my co-author, Maria Stefan, and just have a moment. You know, like, I think we just completely are going to overturn the time machine. I was just talking about going back in time. This is going to overturn a lot of the conventional wisdom about violent insurgency, so we need to make sure it's right, we need to make sure, you know, we cover all our bases and everything. And so we look really carefully at these data, and basically the argument that we talk about in our book is that participation is what matters the most, and a non-state actor campaign against a sitting government or the status quo, what they really need to do is get a ton of people involved. And not just a ton of people, but a very diverse group of people. And the reason is because if you're a non-state actor and you're confronting a state that has considerably more resources, especially considerably more repressive resources than you do, it's probably not wisest to confront that authority in the center, to try to overtake it on its own terms, which is using violence and using just kind of, you know, just attacking it. Usually what you want to do is convince everybody in the population to just stop cooperating or stop obeying the authority. And basically the way to do that, especially to attack those pillars of support, is to get a really diverse group of people on your side. Because the more diverse the group is, the more likely they are to have links with those different pillars of support. So I sort of joke when I talk about this, but there is a phenomenon in international relations called pillow diplomacy, which I actually think matters more now than I ever did before. And what I mean by pillow diplomacy is the phenomenon of, say there's an Indonesian general who's been participating in some repressive exercises in East Timor in the late 90s. They live in East Timor. And his wife comes home one night and is like, you know what? I saw what you did to those kids out there today, and I'm their teacher. And you're sleeping on the couch tonight. You know? Like, this actually happens, and it matters, turns out. It actually matters. So this is kind of a silly example I just brought up. But it really emphasizes the relationships that exist in any society, and the fact that if you can get more people on your side or more people sympathizing with your cause, they really can start to chip away at those pillars of support. So basically, this shows statistically what the effects are of increased participation on the probability that a campaign will succeed. So this should actually say participants per thousand. That was an error on my part. But basically what this is showing is that at the bottom level of participation, we see, you know, a couple thousand members in a group. This is a violent or nonviolent group. You see that there's a very low probability of success, 10% or less. But as the number of participants increases, you can see that there is a massive increase in the probability of success. And at the very highest levels, we're talking about 5 million people in a relatively mid-sized country, then you're going to see here above 80% likelihood of success. So the question is, why is participation linked to nonviolent resistance? And I'm going to make the claim that basically there are lower barriers for people to participate in nonviolent resistance than in violent resistance. So the first lower barrier is the lower physical barrier. It actually requires physical ability to participate in a guerrilla warfare. You usually have to train. It's usually hard living. You know, like they're either in the jungle or they're in the mountains or they're somewhere. It's not fun. So just by that element alone, you're excluding people who don't want to camp and who don't want to train. I was in ROTC, that's like the junior officer training in college, and I quit because I hated getting up at 4 a.m. to train. I would be a horrible insurgent. I just hated it. And so I did something else. The other thing is that usually elderly women, for instance, are not engaged in armed struggle. And that's a huge group of people that you're excluding necessarily just by the physical needs required. So all I'm saying here is that if it doesn't require some sort of training or some sort of camping, you're usually going to get more people who wouldn't necessarily be participating in these types of activities. The second barrier that nonviolent campaigns can overcome is an informational barrier. What I mean by this is that most armed groups have to be clandestine. Just by the nature of their activities, they're underground. They often come up for air every once in a while and to recruit and to engage in operations. But in general, most of what they're doing is very clandestine, very secret. They're underground. And so that makes it really difficult for people to gauge the level to which they are credible as sources of change. Because you don't really know how many people are involved. And part of that's strategic. They don't really want you to know, probably because they don't really have very many people. So it's really difficult for them to communicate this. Whereas with nonviolent campaigns, let's say somebody comes to you. You live in a pretty repressive place. Let's say somebody comes to you and says, there's going to be a huge rally tonight. You sympathize with the cause, but your risk profile is pretty heavy. I mean, you know that you live in this repressive place. This person comes to you, a neighbor, and says, we're going to have a rally tonight. It's in the square just down the street at 8 o'clock. So if you're kind of a rational person and you have a high-risk profile, you might take a look out your window at about 8:15 to see how many people are already assembled. And when there are groups of people that are showing up, say there's already 2,000 people out there, all of a sudden your risk profile drops and you're much more likely to show up. So the key thing here is that most nonviolent tactics are visible. And it's clear how many people are there. And people experience safety in numbers. They have a sense. It's a psychological phenomenon. And actually, it's probably statistically rational, too, because if you're in a group of 6,000 people and the police forces come, the probability that you're going to get your head cracked is lower than if you're in a group of 600 people. So there's some rationality to it. There are also lower commitment barriers. And what I mean by this is that in nonviolent campaigns, most of the tactics available you can do without quitting your day job. You know, I could do it as a professor if I wanted to, and then go back to class. Because basically we're talking about protests, rallies, strikes, boycotts, all kinds of things that are available to me in my life on a daily basis. I can, anytime I can withdraw cooperation from the regime that I live under and do it in impactful ways, especially if there's already an organized campaign, and I don't have to give up my life to do that. In most armed groups, people have to make a serious commitment to join. They often have to say goodbye to their loved ones. They often have to say goodbye to friends. They often have to even submit themselves to a lot of ideological training. And in fact, many groups require people to kill somebody right away to prove that they are not informants. So there are some really difficult choices that people have to make that they don't have to make with nonviolent campaigns. And then there are often moral barriers to participation in violent groups. Now, this is true, more true some places than others, but in general, even when people sympathize with a cause and that they think it's very just, it's still a whole other leap to make, to be willing to kill for it or to die for it. And a lot of people don't have to do that, make that psychological leap to participate in nonviolent resistance. So I mentioned that one of the main strategic points of leverage for nonviolent resistance is the ability to disconnect the center from its pillars of support. And so what this slide shows is the differential rates, or the differential probabilities that increased membership will lead to security force defections. On this side, you've got violent campaigns, and on this side, you've got nonviolent campaigns. So as the numbers of members in an active resistance go up here in violent campaigns, you can see that it actually doesn't really increase much, the probability of security force defections. In fact, this isn't even statistically significant. What it's saying is there's really no relationship here. The highest they're going to go is below 40% the likelihood of creating security force defections, and they're probably going to be more like around 20%. Whereas with the nonviolent campaign, you can see, and this is statistically significant, that as the number of members increases, we have a huge spike in the probability of security force defections. So the more people you have, the more likely you are to be able to chip away at these pillars of support. This doesn't even count economic elites or educational leaders or state media defections. This is just security force defections. So in my mind, that's a pretty strong relationship. So what about this question of, can nonviolent resistance succeed against really brutal regimes? Well, perhaps you won't be surprised to find out that over 90% of the campaigns in our data set experienced violent repression, whether they were nonviolent or not. And it makes some sense because they're not asking for civil rights or gender rights. They're asking for the regime to vacate office and for secession and self-determination. So they're asking for pretty extreme or maximal goals. And so we would expect in such cases for states to defend themselves violently. Now, violent campaigns that face violent repression are less than 20% likely to succeed. It wavers a little bit lower from the mean rates for the success of violent insurgency. But nonviolent campaigns are over 46% likely to succeed. And there are really two reasons why this is the case. The first is the phenomenon of backfire. Backfire is when the intended effect of your repression is totally counterproductive. In other words, you decided to repress a group to make them go home, yet after you repress them, twice as many people show up. That would be backfire. And one of the things that is necessary for backfire to occur is a sense of moral outrage. Now, moral outrage is much more likely to occur when a regime represses a nonviolent or peaceful uprising than it is for them to repress armed guerrillas. Most people understand, even within countries who sympathize, most people understand that if you use violence against the regime, it's going to respond violently. But most people around the world, it turns out, don't understand why a regime should have to do that to peaceful protesters. Another thing that's interesting is that the more people you have in your campaign, the more likely backfire is to occur. And the reason is because another necessary aspect of backfire is that the abuse is communicated to a wider audience. So it has to be known that it went down. And in order for it to be known, usually because they've shut down the state, the opposition media, and they've kicked out foreign journalists, a way that it's known is that it's communicated by word of mouth, you know, from people who were there and who saw it. So the more people you have involved, the more likely that that message is going to be spread really widely. And that's why we see these huge doublings of numbers. In Syria, for instance, if there are 50,000 people assembled in a crowd, the regime shoots at them with snipers. And so the next day, there's like 200,000 people. And that is communicated by word of mouth. Now, the second reason why nonviolent campaigns are superior in the face of violent repression is because of the wide availability of methods available to them when they're actually prosecuting a conflict. So with a violent group, usually what they're doing is they're literally confronting the opponent with violence. They're trying to overwhelm them by attrition. But with a nonviolent movement, they're actually trying to overwhelm them by withdrawing obedience. And there are two groups of methods available to them. One is the method of concentration. This is a thing like a protest or a rally or a demonstration where people group together in a space and they apply pressure that way. They disrupt the society. So you'll see a lot of that. Most people, that's what they think of when you say nonviolent resistance. But there's a second group of methods available called methods of dispersion. And dispersion methods are those where you actually go away. You withdraw, or you stop cooperating. And so an example of this is like a strike. You stop doing what the regime expects you to do or needs you to do in order to maintain power. So a strike or an economic boycott, for instance, is an example of a method of dispersion. And the reason why this helps nonviolent campaigns is that these are so hard to repress. Methods of dispersion are really difficult to repress. I'll give you an example from the Iranian Revolution, and I mean the one from 1978 to 1979. So this was called the 100 Days Revolution. And in the last 10 or so days, the first 90 or so days, there were methods of concentration. There were protests and rallies and funeral processions and all sorts of things happening in the society. Now, after a while, these get pretty predictable. And the regime expects it. They know where people are going to show up. They start shooting at them. It kind of goes into this cycle. But after about 90 days of this, the revolution changed strategies and said, we need to do something that actually really hits the regime's wallet. Because we're in this kind of cycle of showing up and them beating us up right now. So they thought to themselves, what are the sources of the regime's economic wealth? And how is it continuing to pay these officers, you know, to follow orders? And they realized that it was oil wealth. So they went to the oil workers and said, will you strike? And it took them a long time to convince the oil workers to strike, but they ultimately did. And in the last few days of this campaign, the oil workers didn't show up to work. They stayed at home. So basically, what did the Shah do to react? He sent his security forces to their homes and pulled them back out and sent them back to the oil fields where they worked at half pace. Now, you can do that for a day, but you can't do that every day for weeks. And the security forces knew that, and the oil workers knew that. And so the next day they didn't show up to work again, and the security forces refused to go to their homes to pull them out to send them back to work. And that's when the Shah decided to call it quits and took the helicopter out of there. So basically, with nonviolent campaigns, there's a wide array of available tactics that can be applied even in the face of very repressive regimes. They have to be strategic about it. So what about this notion of the fact that they're all just puppets of foreign powers? And I took a look at this, and I was shocked to find that less than 10% of the nonviolent campaigns in the data set actually received any material support from a foreign state. And for them, that means money. So it's very rare for them to get it. Now I know why. Because like myself, most states are just looking for explosions, you know? And when they see an explosion, they think, how can we co-opt that? And so they're not even looking to see when things are when civilians are just casting off their own regime. They're like, what happened? Where did Ben Ali go? Where did Mubarak go? We didn't even know it was coming. It's like, right, because nothing's exploding. So So actually, it's very rare for them to even support nonviolent campaigns. That's also one of those things, you know, when you read in the media about how, like, the Orange Revolution was some U.S. conspiracy or something, or any of that, it's just not the case. I mean, even the intelligence agencies are, you know, they're bewildered by nonviolent conflict because it completely, turns upside down the notion of power that they've got. So it's not happening. Violent campaigns, on the other hand, do get support. About almost 40% of them do. And actually, it's the one thing that really helps them. Because they can't get the numbers of participants that nonviolent campaigns can. But so what they need is more guns and more money, basically, to keep themselves alive. And so violent campaigns are actually going to be really helped by foreign aid. And I think there are plenty of examples that may come to mind about this. Libya, of course, is one. And Kosovo is another. So there are some cases of violent insurgency success. I mean, you probably have thought immediately in your minds, what about Algeria? What about Vietnam? What about the Russian Revolution? What about the Chinese Revolution? These are good examples of successful violent insurgency. And I definitely admit that. Sometimes it works. The question is it worth it? In the long run, what are the consequences of violent insurgency for societies? Well, what Maria and I did was we thought about this in two terms. First of all, what's the consequence for the likelihood that the country will eventually become a democracy? And what's the consequence for the return to civil war later? So just on those two counts, how do these things measure up? Well, it was pretty striking once again. In a country that's faced a nonviolent campaign, within just 5 years, the countries are 41% likely to be democracies. Whereas in a country that have faced violent campaigns, it's only 4%. This is bad news for Libya, right? Basically, what we're looking at here is a huge differential where nonviolent campaigns have occurred, we're much more likely to see democracy. And this should make sense to people that are familiar with work on social capital and sort of good social capital versus bad social capital. Because all kinds of insurgency are examples of social capital. But there's sort of the dark side of it, which is the criminal, kind of violent side. And that's leading to negative outcomes in terms of institutional responsiveness and democracy. And then the question is, what are the likelihood, what's the likelihood for a return to civil war afterward? And we can see again that within 10 years, countries that have faced violent campaigns are 43% likely to return to violent campaigns. In other words, there's like a recurring cycle that occurs in these countries, and it's 15% less for nonviolent campaigns. So the bottom line here is that these countries are better off when they're facing nonviolent campaigns in the long run than when they face violent insurgencies. So I'm hoping that you will help me to embrace a new conventional wisdom about the utility of violence in many of these cases. The first one is that violent resistance is actually, it's usually ineffective compared with nonviolent alternatives, and that means that it's often unnecessary. The second thing is that even against brutal regimes, nonviolent resistance can work. It doesn't always work, and they're not just working because they're nonviolent. They have to be strategic about what they're thinking. They have to broaden their membership. And the third thing is that in countries where there's been nonviolent resistance, we do see the promotion of superior social and political outcomes. So I'm just going to stop in a minute, but I want to kind of trouble you with the question that I'm troubled with right now, which is that how can this actually become the new conventional wisdom? Because there is so much, and I think it's socialized, and I think it's people's just obsession like mine with things blowing up, that there's a sort of fascination with violence and there's a fixation on it. And so how do we sell people on this, especially people that are the hardest sells, which are violent insurgents? You know, how do you go around the world and convince people to use something else? Now, Richard Jackson and I, does anybody know who Richard Jackson is? He's this guy over at Aberystwyth. We were talking about this, and we were saying, you know, de-radicalization isn't really the way we should be viewing a lot of armed groups, because de-radicalization means that they should give up on a lot of what they want politically. What we should be talking about is re-radicalization. That is, how do you get them to still kind of want what they want, but give them a more constructive social and political way to achieve it? So here's what I think. I think that there are kind of three different groups of insurgents out there that I'm hoping to convince. The first is the rational insurgent, and these are my favorites because basically I just say to them, nonviolent resistance is a strategically superior choice, and they say, oh, we're convinced, we'll use it. Usually the rational insurgent is going to have some sort of limited goals that can actually, for instance, be achieved on this planet. And they also, you know, the only thing they're concerned about is that they can succeed in achieving their goals. And so for them, violence is purely instrumental. They don't have any baggage or hang-ups about using violence other than we just think it's the best way for us to get what we want. And so for those types of groups, I think that there's a really high probability that we will be able to convince them to adopt civil resistance if they get the info. So an example of this, actually, is that I was approached when I was giving a talk in Pennsylvania last year by a group, somebody who was part of a group who said that they had come across some research showing that nonviolent resistance was superior. They were armed insurgents, and they decided to stop using weapons and start using civil resistance and thinking really practically about it. That's rational insurgents. I said, yay. So then you have the semi-rational insurgent. This is a group that also has limited goals. You know, there's no hang-ups about the use of violence in their goals. But the problem here is that for them, they've developed a hang-up with staying together as a group. They have established some sort of a stake in the use of violence to maintain their organization or to outbid other organizations. So these are like the groups I look at, terrorist groups in democracies or even some insurgent groups around the world who are in some way or another kind of engaging in this struggle for superiority within their own movement. And so for them, violence hasn't really become instrumental in the classic sense of the word where it's advancing on their major stated goals. It's become demonstrative where they're kind of showing other groups or they're branding their territory politically. And so those groups are going to have a tough time accepting that they should use nonviolent resistance because it might make them lose that fight within their movement. So then you have the non-rational insurgent, and this is a group that has maximalist goals. And by this, what I mean is basically that killing is part of their philosophy. You know, so there are some groups out there for whom killing is part of their philosophy. And there are also people out there who have a psychology to where they just want to use violence. I mean, there are a few. Not very many, thankfully, but there are a few. And so for them, you know, basically the violence isn't even instrumental or demonstrative in a sense. It's just like killing. It's just exterminatory. Dave Grossman wrote this book called On Killing. And in his book he says that there have been all kinds of studies on who kills in war. You know, the armies do studies about their own guys and who does the killing. Turns out that like 2% of the people do almost all the killing. And 1% of them are like real war heroes, and the other 1% are psychopaths. And so the psychopaths are these people, right? They're just like, they really like to kill. So basically, it's very unlikely that these folks are going to want to use civil resistance. And so the way I think about it, when I'm talking to policy audiences, for instance, you know, a lot of times in the U.S., Petraeus and them, they talk about the difference between reconcilables and unreconcilables. And I don't know that it's too useful to think about it that way, but it might be more useful to think about it in terms of, because they're thinking about, when they say reconcilable, they mean reconcilable to our goals. And my argument would be, talk methods, not goals. You know, so here we could look at the different groups that are likely to adopt methods that would be better for society as a whole, as opposed to the ideologies themselves, which I don't think are very useful for us to confront. So this is my info, and I, of course, welcome you to stay in touch. I had flyers over there about the book, and I'm sorry that I couldn't bring the book itself. But if there aren't any flyers left and you want some information, please just get in touch with me, and I'll make sure that you get what you need. And I really welcome your comments from here. Thanks.
Thank you so much.